So it's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Joop de Jong, MD, PhD, who is a professor of cultural and international psychiatry at the VU University and the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. He's an adjunct professor of psychiatry at the Boston University Medical School and a visiting professor at the Rhodes University in South Africa. And we're honestly extremely honored that Joop accepted our invitation to deliver a keynote presentation. Professor de Jong has been active in ISTSS for a great number of years, including as an ISTSS board member. And the main reason we invited him is for his leadership in the development of mental health and psychosocial services for populations affected by war and disaster and poverty in developing countries. And he's also known internationally for his work with refugees in the Netherlands. His work just fits in perfectly with the themes of the meeting that we had in mind. He focuses on moving mental health across borders and into community settings. He worked for years in Africa as a public health expert, a psychiatrist and psychotherapist, and was the founder of the Transcultural Psychosocial Organization, a non-governmental organization that developed mental health and psychosocial support programs in over 20 countries in Africa and Asia, Europe and Latin America that were affected by armed conflicts and disasters. A very large state of service in terms of academic publications, over 250 chapters and papers published in the field of cultural psychiatry, psychotherapy, epidemiology, public mental health and medical anthropology, a multidisciplinary body of work. And recently, Professor de Jong has been co-leading the development of new treatment guidelines for disorders related to stress with the World Health Organization, an important product coming up. As a former PhD student of Professor de Jong, I've personally witnessed the great visionary leadership and mentorship that Joop has provided over the years. So it's my personal wonderful opportunity to be able to present him for a keynote lecture.
Thank you, Wietse, for your kind words, and thank you for the invitation of the organization, the people of the organization. I'm going to take up on Vikram Patel's excellent keynote speech. And I see Vikram's talk as a kind of the warp, and I'm going to patch in some pieces of woof when I talk about public mental health and global mental health. This, by the way, sounds like I'm a pastor. There's a lot of echo here. Okay, my central proposition is that public mental health, I think, is a great challenge for societies because it's a paradigm that may help us to develop a global agenda, and I'm going to try to show how. And then there is also an art of public mental health I'm going to talk about, and the art is always to bridge the global to the local, or that what we regard as universal in psychology and psychiatry to the culture specific. So I'll briefly start with what is public mental health and why do we like public mental health as an upcoming paradigm. It is the discipline, the practice, and the systematic social actions that protect, promote, and restore mental health of a population. And so the key words here is that it's social actions and that's aimed at populations. And what I think is very important to realize, it does not de-emphasize anything we do in the field of our daily work, like our daily psychotherapeutic or pharmacotherapeutic practice. What it does, it envelops these practices in a broader systemic perspective. And what I'll try to show is that the public mental health paradigm will help us to develop new views, but there are also new developments in the field that reinforce and strengthen the public mental health paradigm. So some of you may have seen this before. The lower circle, you see that meta-analysis of psychotherapy, they show that 40% of the variance is explained by contextual variables and only 15% by technique That what we sweat on so many years in our lives. So 40% determined by contextual variables. And in general, we learn very little during our training on how to deal with these contextual variables. Then the second shell, you see that in many places there's a lack of professionals, and you've heard some of these figures mentioned by Vikram. And then in the third layer, there's an enormous discrepancy between the impact of armed violence and disaster around the world and the amount of trauma professionals that are there, and I'll get back to that. So let me introduce a concept I like. It's the traumascape, which I call the systemic dynamics of representations and actions around extreme stress. Now, when I give an example, you immediately understand what I want to say. When something bad happens in the world, and you see that on the left hand, there's a cascade of events. There's pop stars, there's movie stars, there's the politics, the geopolitical considerations, the voter-dependent considerations, like here, the eve of your elections. Obama's very interesting to go to Sandy, etc. So there's always these kind of forces playing a role. Then there's the UN, the government, the NGOs, the churches, the funders. And somehow this mix of forces concocts priorities, which you see in the middle. The focus in a certain era is on either terrorism or human rights or child rights, governance, bad governance, good governance, etc. So what you see then is that funding streams around the world, they follow this focus. You ask anybody in the world, where do these priorities come from? Nobody is sure. Some people say it's the US, some say it's Canada, some say it's Scandinavian countries. But for people trying to set up services and trying to be sustainable and needing 5 to 10 years to set up a sustainable program, this is very worrying, because they start to do something useful and after 3 years, this international forces say, oh, sorry, guys, we have a new priority and we can't help you anymore. And these forces, they determine where attention goes in the world. So when this happened with the tsunami, almost all the expertise and the funding in the world went to the tsunami at the detriment, for example, in Sudan, where there was a war for 30 years, a million people killed, 400,000 refugees. And why I emphasize this so much is that I think that we have to realize that all our professional considerations, our delis, our qualis, our incidence, our prevalence rates, they are often overruled by these forces in the world. So this international landscape of trauma, what I call the traumascape, determines both the content and the geographic areas where things are prioritized in the world. And I think there is a big role here for our family of traumatic stress societies, because I think we have to try to interconnect to kind of get our voice at the global stage and say, well, look, guys, this is what we think is important in terms of global mental health and public mental health and delis and qualis, and not some fancy person somewhere in an office in New York. We don't know why he or she does what. So the traumascape not only works at the global level, but also at the local level. And that's very relevant. And I'm going to give you some trivial examples. When you go to a country, what may happen? You go somewhere in the world and you set up a program. So we were invited to start in Burundi. People know about the genocide in Rwanda. Few people know that in Burundi, Hutus and Tutsis as well, 600,000 people have been killed over the past 20 years. So I was happy to find out there was one psychiatrist in the country. But the psychiatrist had been trained in France. And he was all into Lacan. Our psychoanalyst in the room is already laughing. So I started to have this conversation about psychiatry and Lacan, and it was fantastic. But it was so way beyond what we were thinking of to do in this country. So after a few minutes, I felt like, I'm walking with Freud in the jungle, and we both took some LSD. It was kind of a weird thing. Because this is the trivial reality of what we do. We train counselors, we supervise them, we integrate mental health into primary care, we set up community-based approaches, we train former child soldiers to get a job, a profession, so that they don't take up their arms again. We have adolescents sculpting their own drums, and then they want to organize drum competitions all over the country. And then I also was delighted to find out that there were Belgian brothers who ran one single psychiatric hospital in the country of 60 beds. And then they saw us coming, and they thought, oh, gee, these are real psychologists and real psychiatrists. So they felt, they perceived us as an enormous threat. And we said, no, guys, look, we are going to work in the communities. We're going to help you. We're going to... So for 2 or 3 years, it was kind of a very tense relation. But then, of course, they saw it worked out, because what we did, of course, was helping them to deinstitutionalize their hospital, to set up community service so they could dismiss patients and take new people in their institution. This traumascape also applies to prevention and interventions, both global and local. And now let me start with prevention at a global level. I hope you can read this. On the left hand, you see 5 of the major predictors of war and armed violence around the world. And it's quite shocking to realize that these same 5 predictors that I figured out here are the major 5 predictors of ill health, both somatic and mental ill health around the world. So it's bad governance leading to human rights violations, investment in armament on the right hand, lack of social justice, lack of health policies, low government spending on health. The second is widening socioeconomic gaps, resulting in struggles over resources like water, timber, diamonds, oil. In health, you see an impaired access to sanitation and health. Marginalization of certain ethnic groups. When you look at armed conflict, you see that political power is exercised differently for these different groups, building up to an escalation to war. And again, in the health field, differential access to services, inequity in terms of access to services. Lack of intersectional collaboration between governments, the UN, the civil society, leading to poor engagement in preventive reconstructive efforts and fueling these cycles of violence like you see them in the Central African region and the Middle East. Lack of interconnection in policies in the domain of health on the right-hand side. Inability and unwilling to address crucial social determinants outside the health sector. And the last factor that's important as a predictor is that health and nutrition per se, and there's some new research showing that, are causal factors predictors of war and armed conflict. And then what you see in the health field is a further deterioration of services around the world. So I think it's quite important to realize that these factors are, in fact, all factors that you can prevent. And again, I think this is a big challenge for our family of trauma societies, to develop a global agenda, meaning that we have to learn to connect to key actors around the world, not just connecting here to New York at the UN siege, but connecting all over the place. I'll get back to that later. And I think it's also a big research challenge in terms of what are the common pathways, what are the methodical models that we can use to see how these pathways to political violence and war, how they work and how they go. And that's another question to our trauma societies. Would it be interesting? Would we want to go more interdisciplinary? Okay, then something about prevention at the local level. And then I used the concept that's quite common in prevention. It's going upstream. Like you're standing at a river and there's a dead baby coming down in a second, and then you go upstream. Now, we had that in Cambodia when we went to Cambodia 20 years after Pol Pot, and there was not a single psychiatrist nor a psychologist, and we went into the villages and we did a rapid appraisals, and all Cambodia was full of what was called war widows. And what you expect of women everywhere in the world, they get together, they chat, they laugh, they go to the well, they talk. But these women were locked in their rooms for 20 years. And then when we talked to the village leaders, they said, you know, we don't dare to move, we don't dare to do anything, because in the time of Pol Pot, whatever we did, we were killed. And then the Vietnamese came, and then we were killed again. So we don't move. So very slowly, we had to kind of work towards these communities, work with the local forces in these communities to get these widows out of the houses, which eventually we succeeded in. And then we started these self-help groups here under the mango bomb or in the local pagoda. To give an example of the U.S. prevention at the local level, here on the left hand you see the real Zaytun, not the Zaytun of the Eggers novel. This is the real Zaytun. And right hand you see New Orleans. When this happened, and then we heard in Holland about this New Orleans thing, this Katrina. You know, we lived two-thirds of our country is under the sea level. So in terms of prevention, we were shocked, really shocked, at a rich country like the U.S., that it has risk calculations of 1 in 1,000 years that such a disaster in New Orleans might happen. Whereas all our risk calculations in the Netherlands, all the dikes and the dams we have, they are all built on risk calculations of 1 in 100,000 years. So in terms of prevention, again, you wonder what kind of what is going on that there is this rich country with all this expertise, and where is the social connection that runs it. So this is two examples of prevention at the local level. Now, I want to have a short theoretical intermezzo, and I want to talk about the critique of PTSD in our field. And when I try to grapple all this critique in the literature, I had to go back to Parsons. And Parsons, he says, societies transform social problems in individual problems, and then they take out the social origin of the root of those problems. And then people are allowed to enter the sick role, meaning they are exempted from their duties, they get care, but they are obliged to seek treatment and cure. But after accepting the sick role, people are depoliticized. And Parsons, and the same applies to Ivan Illich, the Mexican philosopher with a theory about social and structural iatrogenesis, in my view, throws light on this PTSD debate. And this PTSD debate, in my view, goes along two lines. This one is a politicization, medicalization debate, and the second is, in fact, a validity debate. Now, here you see some of the social science text about our field, that we PTSD people, we advance political agendas on the global stage. We abuse the power of medical science. We are influenced by emotionology. I don't know what it is. It seems to be an Anglo-American invention. I don't know the word. Which is detrimental to post-war recovery. Then Derek Sommerfeld, yeah, he's always good in these quotes. Derek, I see him as the non-data-driven Buddha of anti-psychiatry. He says the mental health is a trauma industry. PTSD is a tool to pathologize whole societies. It's self-aggrandizement, etc. So if you go back to Parsons, what the discussion is about is that we medicalize and individualize social problems, and the critics handle a conspiracy model to ascribe power to the interests of us as a mental health industry and pharmaceutical companies, and of course, there's always a kernel of truth in any conspiracy theory. The second line of critique gets, again, under two strands. One is historicity. On the left hand, you see Alan Jung and Jones and Wesley. They say, well, you see, this PTSD thing was a thing that the U.S. needed when the Vietnam veterans came back. There were these narratives, they were providing services, and then they needed a diagnosis. So he wrote his book, The Harmony of Illusions. And then later on, Wesley and Jones, they say, well, you know, in all the wars, this avoidance and intrusion, that's quite a culture-bound thing these days, that we have these days, that's quite culture-bound. Because in the old days, everybody only complained about somatic symptoms when we talked about shell shock. And on the right hand, there is another group of scholars, like Shea with his Achilles in Vietnam, and a whole range of other authors, that boils down to PTSD is a common human problem that has been known under different names for hundreds of years. Now, when I reread all this critique and all this literature, I found it a bit bizarre, to be honest. Because I think it's a truism that all psychopathology changes over time. I don't think any of us doubts that schizophrenia these days is different from Bleuler's dementia praecox. I don't think that anybody doubts that Jeannette's and Charcot's hysteria is the same as the associative disorders these days. And I think that nobody doubts that Burton's melancholia is the same as our depression. I'll get back to that later as well. So this historicity debate is a variant of the validity debate. And the validity debate has to do with the perennial universalism versus cultural relativism, cultural particularism debate. The question is, mental health disorders, are they all the same over the world? Do they have the same prevalence rates? Or is the phenomenology very different? Are the prevalence rates for certain disorders very different? And are certain disorders related and particular relative to certain cultures? Now, if you want to be informed in all this debates, I advise you to read a perfect, beautiful paper by Devin Hinton and Fernandez on these issues related to DSM-5. Devin is sitting here at the end of the audience in depression anxiety. I think that's really a beautiful paper. So to get back to what I just mentioned before, this critique, do we try to advance political agendas on the global stage? My suggestion and my answer is yes. I think we do, and it's good that we do, because we try to prevent rape, we try to prevent domestic violence, femicide, and all kinds of other human rights violations. And then talking about this historicity and the changing of PTSD in time, I think that the research question is not whether psychopathology changes, because we all agree there, I think, but what we address very little is how psychopathology changes by history, society, and culture. So, going from the global to the local, the universe to the culture specific, there's also cultural critique about PTSD at the local level. And here you see two important concepts from the anthropological, psychological and psychiatric anthropological literature. One is idioms of distress, a socially, culturally consonant means of experiencing and expressing distress in local worlds. So the core there is that it's a language, it's an idiom, it's a way of communicating. And then secondly, there is the cultural syndrome substituting the previous culture-bound syndrome, which is a recognized cultural ailment that encompasses a set of associations around cultural symbols and symptoms, you might say, leading people to help-seeking, etc. And here you see a spectrum. On top you see a range of trauma reactions that one day some of us hope that it will become a spectrum disorder, maybe in DSM-6. Many of us, like myself, we see DSM-5 as a missed opportunity or even a lost case. For some of us, others are thrilled by it. And on the right hand, you see these idioms that are subdivided in externalizing idioms, the shooting, the AMOC, the acting out, the mass sociogenic illness, the nervous in Latin America, and the internalizing idioms, the veteran syndrome, the low back pain, the RSI, the sick building syndrome, etc. Many of us focus on the blue circle, but I think it's important to realize that across the world, the blue circle, with the PTSD and the common mental disorders, is not what the priority is for many people around the place. And here you see a map with some of these hundreds or even thousands of idioms and episodes of mass sociogenic illness around the world, whether in the army or in schools. On the right hand, upper hand, you see a picture of the salt hysteria in China, so that after the disaster, the Fukushima disaster in Japan, millions of Chinese, they ran to shops in panic that they had to buy salt to prevent themselves for the consequences of the radioactive fallout. Similarly, when you look at the US on the left hand, when you look at these idioms and these as local cultural issues, you see that fallout and terrorism is often a kind of core issue that people are worried about. So you see this phenomena around the world, and the content of this phenomena in different areas in the world is different. Like Koro was the syndrome And you saw in Southeast Asia in the right hand upper the photo, you see this little contraption that you can put on your penis, and then you put a rope, and then you prevent your penis from withdrawing in the abdomen. And because when your penis withdraws in the abdomen, you die. That's the feeling. These are the epidemics of Koro in China, Malaysia, India, etc. But now Koro has changed to Africa. So there's a whole bunch of cases from people in Africa. They meet an evangelical pastor from the U.S., they shake hands, and at that same moment, their penis disappears. So on the left hand down, you see a picture of a Pentecostal church about this literature, about 500 cultures in the world believing in spirit possession, that the normal personality is taken over by other spirits and ghosts. That's a very common belief around the world. So when you look at these epidemic phenomena, some of the characteristics are that there's a high level of stress in the population. There's mostly precipitating event, like the Gulf War syndrome. There's this stories about experimental vaccines, etc. There's a local relevant interpretation that endorses the threat. Then the complaints, they spread very quickly after initially being mainly somatic. And then the subgroup shows considerable disability, mortality, or dropout. And often it goes at very large costs. Like we had this small air crash in Amsterdam, and it was an Israeli Al-Al plane, and then the rumor went that it was filled with plutonium. So there was a secret weapon in this Israeli plane that crashed on the suburb of Amsterdam. And then even 10 years later, we had to spend tens of millions of euro of doing research to absolutely make sure that all these people that had vague complaints, but it was not related to plutonium or any other toxic agent. So that's a pattern you see happen more often. Then there is another development in our field that strengthens the public mental health paradigm, and many of you have been giving talks during this Congress, and I'll be brief about it, seeing resilience not so much as a personal characteristic and a personal trait, but rather as a social ecological process of adaptation, which is also the title of the Ungar book that came out last year, and it's called Social Ecological Resilience. And then you see here some of these definitions from Antonovsky and then Bonanno and Stephen Hopfuls, who see as well, about resilience as staying absorbed and focused despite traumatic stress. Tutol's definition of those assets and processes existent on all socio-ecological levels that have a relation with positive outcomes after a situation of massive stress. And then if you look at some of the studies that reinforce that tendency to go to a social ecological paradigm, you see three American studies, and they show that after Hurricane Andrew, that material resourceless, insurance, loss of possessions, September 11, again insurance after Katrina, were more important predictors than the traumatic stress per se. It's very interesting, in my view, that this insurance issue only comes out in American studies. I haven't seen any other study. And you now have your elections, and you have this big debate in the U.S. about Obamacare, etc., which to us is a very, very, very interesting but also quite bizarre discussion, of course, but that you have these issues about insurance and that they are so important, and yet you have the discussion in the state. So here is a whole bunch of other studies from a number of low-income countries where we did research, from Darfuri and Afghani refugees, Liberia, showing that quality of camps, daily hassles, safety concerns, wealth inequality at the village level, they are all more important predictors and factors than traumatic stress. A study in the Netherlands showing that when asylum seekers wait more than 2 years for their asylum status, the rate of PTSD and depression doubles. And that is there was no relation with the stress they underwent in Iraq during the war. And a small study among the Tibetans, again an interesting study, that the Tibetans after the Chinese invasion, they were not so much traumatized by losing their possessions, but they were traumatized by the destruction of their temples and their monasteries. And when you see this picture, in fact, it's very logical, these findings that I just mentioned. On the left hand, you see these people around Addis Ababa, 70,000 refugees from the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea, each living in one square meter of cotton. On the right-hand side, you see, first in the upper right-hand, you see a picture of Haiti. But when we went a year after the earthquake to Haiti, the rubble was removed, but all the same misery was still there. And then in the middle, you see the Sichuan earthquake in China, with also a mortality rate of about 230,000 people, 4.5 million people affected. And then after a year, going to China, they all have these little houses that you see in the middle, and they all have this kind of IKEA outfit down below with a bed and a fridge and a TV, and it works. So, in fact, I think we all agree that it's common sense that they do better than the people in Haiti. So, to conclude, resilience implicates both the social ecological context rather than individual characteristics, and as Steve Hopeful just wrote in a chapter, it's important to incorporate our models in a wider social-cultural context. Now let me go back to practice. Because the public mental health paradigm, as I said, accommodates both the global and the local. And when we develop interventions, the art is that we have to fit them to the local situation and the local scape. This slide from the World Health Organization shows the density of mental health professionals. And the light green area is where there are very few mental health professionals in the world. When you remember my slide about the predictors of war, the light green areas are also the areas in the world where these predictors are predominantly present around the world. Now, Vikram Patel told you there were 3,000 psychiatrists in India. There are also 3,000 psychiatrists in China. There are also 3,000 psychiatrists in my country. But the population of India and China is 6 to 75 times bigger than the population of my own country, the Netherlands. Sri Lanka and Nepal, they have 30 psychiatrists after many years of war. In Africa, there's a whole range of countries, post-conflict countries, that have either 0, 1, or 2 psychiatrists. So Eritrea, Sudan, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Burundi, Namibia, Angola, Mozambique, they have 1 or 2 psychiatrists and they have a few psychologists. These are disasters, natural disasters, and the PV is political violence. So you see these big disasters, like the biannual floodings in Bangladesh costing 30,000-40,000 lives, Pakistan, the flooding, the earthquake, the political violence in the Middle East, the Central African Lakes region, West Africa, the Middle American region. And then you realize, when you look at the figures down on the left-hand side, the consequences of this political violence is much more predominant in low-income countries. So the consequences are a factor 10 bigger in low-income countries. And although hurricanes strike much more in the West, again, the casualties occur predominantly in low- and middle-income countries. And although we are so scared in Europe and the U.S. about refugees caused by all these disasters, only 1 in 12 reaches the West, and 75% stay in these already impoverished countries. So, as Vikram has said, we want collaboration in addressing the mental health gap. We want to collaborate with other sectors. We want to collaborate with all kinds of people by task sharing and task shifting. And we have a number of instruments. There's the Mental Health Gap Intervention Guide that he already mentioned. He launched by the Director General of World Health Organization in 2010. And then there are the new guidelines that Wietzetol just mentioned. Jonathan Bisson has played a huge role in these guidelines. Wietz and other people as well. And these are the priorities that are covered in these guidelines. It's acute traumatic stress syndrome symptoms, it's dissociation, bedwetting, insomnia, hyperventilation, PTSD, and bereavement in the absence of mental disorder. And we think that's an important tool to add to this mental health gap book that can be used to train local people in different countries. And we hope we can present it next year here in ISDSS. So as Freecom Patel mentioned, the global mental health movement aims at task sharing by involving specialists in primary care. But then my question is, if you look at these light green areas in the previous slide, how do we do that when there are almost no mental health professionals at all, or when there are no trauma specialists? Because China may have 25,000 psychologists, but only 400 or 500 of these psychologists have any training in any type of trauma. So then task shifting, training of trainers by training layers of people that train then cascade down, training huge groups of people in the community, health workers, village health workers, supervising, etc., etc. It works. There's a whole range of examples over the world. We have been doing that for 25 years ourselves. But still, even though we have successful models, there's an enormous issue of sustainability. And we talk about functional sustainability, meaning training enough manpower and supervising them and making sure that you compensate for attrition due to brain drain or due to HIV. But on the other hand, there's also financial sustainability. And financial sustainability is the big problem of our field in low and middle income countries. We have to really experiment with very new models to try to get financial local sustainability, because governments, most low-income country governments, they spend 0.5% to 1% on mental health, whereas they should spend at least 7% on mental health. So I come with a somewhat controversial idea that I think we also have to involve healers and healing churches. Mind you, I'm an atheist, but I think we need to also involve the churches, and we have to work with them on these idioms of distress that I just mentioned. So here in the circle, you see these areas where there are almost no trauma specialists or any mental health specialists. And these are the same areas in the world where 1 in 200 or 1 in 600 of any country of the population is a healer. They have long healing traditions. They have excellent communication skills. If you study them, I've done quite some research among healers, they do fantastic. They have an amount of intuitive intelligence. They don't have academia, but they have an enormous wisdom. And they're often very smart. I mean, they never had a possibility to go to school. And then there are these churches with about 500 million people belonging to these evangelical and Pentecostal churches, and about 50 to 100 million of them going into trials a couple of times a year, where they act out their problems, where they have a cathartic thing, where everybody embraces them and praises the Lord, etc., etc., etc. There is a lot of anthropological research on all these issues of healers and churches, but we don't have a clue how effective they are. We don't have research on their effectiveness. And when you discuss this, people always come up with objections, and that's true. On the left hand, you see a patient in the shrine in Afghanistan where people with chronic schizophrenia, they're just put on a chain, they get water and bread, and then when they lose 20 kilos, there's so much left in the brain in any way that even the neurotransmitters, they all kind of have disappeared, so the psychosis also kind of evaporates. And on the right-hand side, you have this healer in Africa, in Mali, and he, like most healers, he offers all kinds of treatments for worms, for HIV, for infertility, even for problems with your car and other machinations. So in my view, if we want to alleviate the traumatic stress mental health gap, we do need the vehicles of task shifting and task sharing, but we also need to seriously consider hybrid approaches with other people in the communities, and it involves healers and churches. And we also have to remember that whatever we say or want, people go there anyhow. People go everywhere in the world. They go to churches. To healers. Apart from having very complex help-seeking patterns, which in a way is very good for us, but because the few trauma specialists and the few mental health providers we have in these countries, they kind of then treat a small group of people with more serious psychological disorders in the higher tiers, the higher part of this public health, public mental health pyramid. In addition, I think we need to be aware of local expressions of trauma because they may be more salient. So if you have these local expressions like the Tusk Fish in Afghanistan or the Shinta Rock in Bangladesh or some of these idioms that Andy Rasmussen studied in East Africa, people immediately say, oh, that's what I have. It partly overlaps with PTSD, but it's the local priorities, the local image of when you have a problem, that's what I feel and that's what I bring forward. So it evokes empathy, it's more salient, and it induces help-seeking among local people. So to conclude, I'll spend a few words on professional competencies. We think we live in a rational world, and some of you may have seen this. This is my favorite public mental health model. In red on the right hand, you see ourselves as practitioners of psychotherapy and pharmacotherapy. And then there's on the left hand is primary, secondary, tertiary prevention, at the national, international level, the community level on top, and the family and individual level, and then it's universal, dedicated, and selective. All our daily jargon in the prevention field. Looks very rational. But this is what health systems look like in real life. So we are in that red circle on the left. We all have some idea about the mental health structure of our countries, private practitioners, community mental health services, psychiatric hospitals. We often have very little idea of all these forces on the right hand, our finance ministries, all the legal issues around our field, the Ministry of Education, all these forces. But this is in peace. And now this is what it looks like after a disaster. So nowadays you get hundreds of NGOs and humanitarian agencies flying themselves in the tsunami after the earthquake in Haiti. You have the military coming and doing good work and setting up tent camps, etc., etc., but often undermining local capacities and disempowering local people who can contribute. Then on the right upper hand, you have hundreds of young students with a rich uncle or aunt that fly themselves in and say, well, I think it's a good idea to do some charity work in the third world. Then you have the FEMA and the other disaster experts. I think when you read the latest book of Kahneman, he talks about the predictive value of any disaster risk expert, and then it's quite shocking to see what he comes up with. So you have these NGOs, you have the peacekeepers, you have the diplomats that want to mitigate when it's political, and then you have the UN, which is a world in itself. You have UN OCHA for the coordination, the ECOSOC, the UNDP, the UNESCO, the UNICEF, the World Health Organization, the Food and Agricultural Organization, the World Food Program, the Women's Organization, and many more. And they are supposed to coordinate, etc. But what you often see, they are as competitive with each other as the other actors in this field. Although, of course, they also contribute, of course. And they often don't understand at all what we are about. So let me give you an example. We worked in the refugee camps, the 100,000 Bhutanese refugees that were thrown out of Bhutan, and they stayed in Nepal, and we were asked to set up a program there. So I went to talk with the public health officer in Kathmandu, and he knew his epidemiology. So he said, you have this thing that you call PTSD. And he thought in terms of like when you think in terms of contagious infectious disease, like tuberculosis, it's an incident pot. You have this pot with cases of tuberculosis. You take one out, you treat it, and it's out of the pot. And you go on, and then you can calculate how much time it needs to get all these cases of tuberculosis or whatever treated. So he said, you have the thing of PTSD. And he required us to come back 5 times, and he wanted a graph that we would show that if we would treat so many cases of PTSD with this prevalence and incidence, that we could stay so many months in this camp, and then everything would be solved. Then another issue is that the UN has regulations and rules, of course, but they often don't follow it. So in Afghanistan, we set up a program, and I was there when the Minister of Health and the two Vice Ministers of Health in Kabul, they told the World Bank guy, an American, he said, you know, we have all this funding pledged by governments, and these are our 7 packages of basic health care in our country. Maternal and child health, public nutrition, communicable, and mental disease. So the minister said, look, we have been going for 25 years through all kinds of wars, and we want mental health as part of the basic packages. But the American, nice public health guy, nice guy from the World Bank, went back to Washington, and he upheld this process for more than a year before actually the process, this whole program of mental health requested by the government with money that the World Bank should follow the local priorities. These are the new roles all over the world. Pity just, it was just a kind of, obstacle. It was kind of stagnated by this whole process. Okay, so health systems in post-disaster, they rapidly get more complex. One of the reasons being that increasingly around the world you see increasingly complex public-private alliances in funding health issues. I think we also need a new generation with additional competencies, with mental health professionals in the role of core team players. And to give you an idea of how that might look like, on the right upper-hand side are the core skills, delivering treatment, doing referrals, consulting with colleagues, training other people, all the interpersonal skills that we get during our training. These are the universal skills. Then at the secondary preventative level, there's the training and task sharing and task shifting that we have been mentioning a number of times in this conference. And then further down, there's the issue of collaboration, of working with the local communities, of training local people from the communities, and also working with healers and churches and working with the complementary and alternative mental health medical sector, which, you know, increases all over the world, not only in Africa and Asia. You know, the 2 papers in the New England Journal of Medicine by Eisenberg showing how quick the healthcare consumption in the U.S. Increased over a couple of years. So the increase in consumption in the complementary and alternative sector, also in our field, is huge around the world. So that requires new skills from all of us. So to conclude my talk, I talked about public mental health as a paradigm for all the trauma societies to develop a global agenda. And I think what we could try as trauma societies is to have a kind of a meta-systemic higher level in the world where we link with many different players, the UN systems that are almost in all continent and all continental capitals, but also linking much more to the psychological associations, and especially to link up and reinforce this global mental health movement, because I think we have an enormous potential and there is a lot to be gained by synergy. I think that this public mental health paradigm is a vehicle for global mental health, and it can also help us in bridging the global to the local in terms of both prevention, practice, and theory. And I gave 2 examples of the theory of the trauma spectrum, the idioms of distress, the cultural syndromes, in addition to PTSD and the resilience. I think it also helps us to understand the global and the local dynamics, what I call the trauma scape. I think further that in low and middle income countries, idioms of distress and other expressions are often more salient for the local population. They require task shifting and sharing, but they also require unorthodox interventions and research to mitigate the treatment gap. I think that the widespread critique on PTSD as a culture-bound construct reminds us of the importance to study how psychopathology is molded by culture, society, and history. And I think that increasing complexity of health systems in any country demands that the traumatic stress societies, that we rethink the competencies of trauma professionals. And we just had a very interesting conference in Amsterdam funded by the NATO and Ray Rosen and Joe Ruzek, they are writing a large paper on how we conceptualize new competencies, both in high-income countries, middle-income countries, low-income countries, high concentration of mental health and trauma professionals versus middle and extremely low concentrations of mental and health and trauma professionals. And I hope that this document and this paper that's coming out in the next half year, it will help us to give a push towards these new developments. Okay, this is what I wanted to say. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks for that the wonderful talk, lots of synthesis and very thought-provoking. I'm sure there's going to be lots of questions we have and comments and feedback, and we have around 15 minutes to spend on that.
It was a wonderful talk. Harold Cutler worked with the VA system in North Carolina. It's a wonderful talk, and it reminded me, though, of how important it is for us to learn both globally but also locally about public health issues. And, you know, when you were talking about working with healers, and I fully agree, we've tried to reach military people through congregational leaders in communities. And what's kind of interesting is first we tried having mental health professionals go out and lecture to congregational leaders. And we found out that since they weren't psychiatrists, they weren't interested in becoming psychiatrists, so they weren't very happy with us, even though they thought what we were doing was good. They said, we're too busy to become psychiatrists. We're busy doing what we're doing. So we weren't connecting with them in ways that were actually helpful in succeeding and connecting to the people in their community. So then we went back and we worked with the VA's National Chaplain Center, and we developed a training in which psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers trained chaplains, and then chaplains went out and trained congregational leaders because they, first of all, were more accepted by congregational leaders than medical people. It's kind of like your story about these are real psychologists with the Belgian brothers. But chaplains, chaplains speak to chaplains, they understand, they speak the same language. And our VA chaplains who work in our hospitals side by side with mental health professionals were very good and are very good, and we're disseminating this nationally, at explaining to congregational leaders what you do need to know in your terms and when you just can turn things over to us and when you can handle things yourself. And so we have a lot to learn before we go out and say, okay, I'm a mental health person, I finally got it with public health. It takes a lot of time to learn to do this well.
Yeah, I think your example is a beautiful example of how you try to decentralize and how you try to kind of shift certain services from higher levels, more specialist levels, to lower levels. And I think what your chaplains have in common with primary healthcare workers in many low-income countries, but also what they have in common with healers, is that they have a much higher accessibility. So they are mentally, socially, culturally, maybe also financially more accessible, and they're closer to the troops. And so I think there's a lower threshold, like when you talk about churches or when you talk about healers, than when you talk about all kinds of professionals.
It was a great talk. I wonder if I could ask you to push you a little bit. One of the things that is a problem, and we keep talking about it, and it doesn't seem to get anywhere, is there's a kind of a parallel play going on between the Euro-American culture, if you will, that creates ICDs and DSMs, and the cross-cultural idioms of distress context that you've talked about, we've heard about. There's been so many wonderful symposia this meeting. And people, and then it gets played out even in the UN between the social models, the UNHCR people, and then the so-called medical model. It's almost a dirty word, the medical model of the UNICEF and the WHO people. And if you wear your pointy-headed Western DSM ICD hat, you do find PTSD everywhere, and translating some of the core competencies or the core constructs. In fact, you gave a wonderful talk yesterday morning, in fact, showing how some of the constructs in cognitive behavioral treatment can be translated very, very effectively in a very relevant, accessible cultural context with very good outcomes within that same cultural context. Can you talk more about how we can make bridges that really work rather than this parallel play, which it doesn't seem to get anywhere?
Well, Matt, if I understand you well, I think you addressed two issues, isn't it? One is the validity issue of PTSD and other trauma reactions. And the second is you also talk about a contradiction between mental health versus the psychosocial. There's two kind of fields of tension there in the world.
But I'm not complaining anymore. What I'm really doing is I'm asking you to help contextualize that in an operational way.
Well, there is a tension here between disciplines as well. So you have the social science and the anthropologist in one way, and you have the psychiatrist, the diehards on the other side. So what I always need two things to show this. So here is the DSM criteria for schizophrenia and PTSD. The category fallacy is you go with this DSM criteria, whether as a clinician or as a researcher, and you go over the world, and you don't test the construct validity of this Western culture-bound American DSM thing, as some call it. I mean, this is not true, but this is what some people want to believe. So what you should do, of course, you should look at whether the local symptoms in the culture that you would find with qualitative anthropological methods, whether they fit these DSM criteria, whether they overlap, whether the local symptoms are more important than the DSM symptoms, whether it's like this or like this. Now, the diehards in our field, let's say the real shrinks, we tend to believe that these things, these DSM criteria apply all over the world. But there's a countercurrent saying, oh no guys, you have it completely wrong. Because when we go in these cultures, we see that many people have this and not your thing. Throw it away. And we say, well, the thing. So what in fact what happens, I think the converging point is that this is important. So, oh, there's a mic here, I'm sorry. So here are the DSM symptoms, and here are the local symptoms, and you kind of have to look at how they present in different cultures. And I think we have to very seriously question. I think at the end, what I hope that our system will go towards in 30 years, we have now cultural neuroscience. The brain is not the same all over the world. So I think we'll get kind of major diseases that are the same all over the world, proven by neuroscience, cultural neuroscience, but with modifications around the place. And then underneath we have all these cultural symptoms that are related sometimes to certain areas or groups or whatever. So this is a long discussion, but I think that's the way it's going. Your second issue, just very briefly, I think there's often it's a false contradiction between mental health and psychosocial care. I think it's a spectrum. And in these settings, it's very hard to say, well, guys, I deal with traumatic stress, but sorry, you have that family member that's chained with schizophrenia for 30 years, has never seen an antipsychotic, I can't deal with you. Or 3% of the population, many African countries, has generalized epileptic convulsions, saying, you know, we don't like to treat you because that's not our thing. That's very hard. But so I think these things have to come together, especially in these disaster areas. I hope this is addressing your question.
Yes, yep,
I think we need more time for this, Matt.
Yep, a great talk. And I'm going to, Stephen Hopfall, I'm going to address Matt's question, I think, and want your response to it. It's not that PTSD doesn't exist. But if we look back at your slides that you showed, for example, the PTSD is best predicted by losses that occurred after the event or were recognized after the event, coming back and seeing that your house is gone when you got back to New Orleans after the flood. that the current theories of PTSD are wrong. They cannot be true. And it's not that there's not a neuro basis, but the neuro basis must be set by things like safety and resources and ecological events. So it's not that PTSD is not there, it's the medical search for the reason, which goes back to, you know, trying to find schizophrenia related dementia praecox and syphilis. That's what's wrong. The theories cannot be true. They must be rejected, and this more international data has to be looked at. It is not in the reviews of any of the major theories on PTSD today. And the same people that make the reviews, like Bruin and Foe, et cetera, have to look at that international data, and they'll see that their theories are wrong, and because they're smart people, they'll come up with understandings that are correct. This has to be included. It is not in those reviews. But your point on it. And I think, I know that you must agree because, you know, I've learned so much from you, but go with it.
Well, I fully agree. I think the direction in the world is going with DSM-6, I think we're going to get higher order constructs. And I hope that when we get to these higher order constructs and we get to modular treatment, like Dave Barlow is proposing, I think we then we may be able to include data sets from other places in the world, because there's also a problem with these other countries. Many of the data sets and the big research comes from the U.S. So there is a hegemony, and there is a kind of imperialism, some call it. Some call it the Americanization of psychiatry around the world. But on the other hand, many of these other cultures are also not so productive. So they should also kind of come up with counter data and showing what is going on elsewhere. So we also need more, let's say, more equity in that sense, also in terms of research, etc. And of course, you are a very rich country, so you can have this influence. So yes, please.
Yeah, I'd like to echo the thanks for the very stimulating, thought-provoking talk. One of your slides, I think, towards the middle, you made a comment about how, with the structure of just having a few highly trained psychologists or psychiatrists in some of these countries where there's a lot of healers, it would sort of, if I understood you correctly, it would sort of work its way out because those people would be left dealing with the very extreme, very severely ill or severely handicapped, low-functioning people, something to that effect. They would get the most extreme cases, and the local healers would
you mean
basically
the healers?
Be able to deal with everybody else. Is that
no, I think it works. If I understand you well, you see, I think healers most often they start to deal with the lighter psychosocial cases.
Right, that's
they're very good at that. There's a lot of anthropological literature proving it. So there's a kind of filtering process where the lighter, the less serious psychological problems are dealt with by the healers, the social issues, and then by filtering, you get like the more serious case, they get to the psychiatric services.
Right. Yes. But how would you control for the fact that there's not going to be equal access to those people at the top? That would assume that someone who has a very severe disorder at the bottom would have the same access that, you know, say, to make it simple, say, in an African country, a European person might have much easier access to the psychiatrist than an African person. So,
I'm just wondering if
that seems like that would be a very big problem in some of these places.
Yes, it's a huge problem because all these services in these low-income countries they're concentrated in the capitals. The few professionals don't want to go out. The public health structure is weak. They need private practice to survive. They don't want to go out there when there's a disaster, when there's people coming from other countries speaking different languages, having different explanatory models, etc. So I fully agree with you. So that's why most public mental health people, and that's also what Vikram Patel is often hammering on and the global mental health movement, is you have to decentralize and you have to train local people and you have to dilute your wine in terms of how you talk about competencies. And it's like with the barefoot doctor thing at the time of Alma Ata. You warn that certain things are treated by people who we might regard as non-qualified, but it's better than nothing. So that's why you have this, why you need this public health model, because that's how you can decentralize and hand over task, etc. But it's a very, very fundamental issue that you bring up.
Joop, I think it's a wonderful talk. I mean, my only problem is I think you may be being a little too reductionistic in your approach. And that's actually a joke. But because I really agree that, to follow Matt's metaphor, the parallel play issue is that many would say in the U.S. that things are getting too biomedical. It's a little surprising for me to hear you say that you think, the basic biology may differ, of the brain may differ, in different societies. I think what you're really pointing out is that there are resource differences across the world, and that there are many things in addition to what we would consider to be traumatic events that can affect behavior in a negative way, and there may be different ways to address and remedy those deficits. But if you're in a situation basically where you have no resources, you have no food, no water, people are attacking you all the time, I don't know, short of providing those resources, I mean, how you can address those in a public health way. So I wonder if you would just comment on whether we are setting up, if it's biological versus psychosocial, whether that is creating a problem or whether there's a role in mental health to take humanitarian aid as well as mental health and other kinds of things to address these massive public health problems. That's too much to answer, so I apologize for that.
No, it's a complex issue. Let me react brief. Of these predictors that I mentioned, there are a number of predictors that are related to poverty and unequal incomes, etc., and then all the problems of disasters and wars. I think when I talk about connecting, and when I talk about synergy, and when I talk about multisectoral collaboration, it means that whenever you are in the field, and I think it's the same here in the States, and Harold's example is a good example of that, is that you have to look at the other sectors in terms of education, of rural development, of community, civil society, of social and cultural capital that's everywhere. And you have to see how you link up with these people and how you create synergy, and in the sense that you see whether you can work together in certain issues like working in schools, working with children, working with traumatized youth, working with youth groups and organizations, and in other domains, you'll work yourself more in the mental health field. So again, it comes to, I think, a horizontal set of collaborators that where you respect each other and see who refers whom to what. And in many of these low-income settings, and that's often much more easy than here in the West. I mean, in the West, you mostly try to kind of find your way through a system that's much too complex. Though I had this slide with these complex health systems in low-income countries, but there is almost nothing. So whatever you bring there, it's good. So when you talk with the rural development people and the people who talk about vocational skills training, not only for the childhood, but also the combatants. I mean, in Angola, to give an example, they disarmed the army and then they put all the Kalashnikovs in one heap and then they got fed up because they got no salary. They took all the Kalashnikovs and they went back to war. So, but then you can say, well, when you talk with these people who give this professional skills training, you can then say, well, guys, if you have somebody who's really quite emotionally labile, et cetera, send them to... So I think in general that works out. But it's a complex picture, and it's, of course, it's variable around countries. Yeah. There's one more question there.
So Gavin Rees from the Dart Center. I'm interested in the cultural idioms of distress idea. So, the idea that we go to particular places and we have to tailor our approach to the locals in the room. I mean, I'm wondering, though, is how granular that approach needs to be in terms of research and thinking about the theory of what we do. So obviously in anthropology, there's this constant battle between universalism and relativism. And so the question is just how specific to the local place do we need to be?
So is it, you know, this particular classroom in Burundi? Is it a particular province in Burundi? Is it a region around Burundi and so forth? In other words, are there parallels between different experiences in different cultural settings? So, for instance, thinking about ideas of spirit possession in East Africa, are they similar to ideas of spirit possession in Burundi? Should we be thinking systematically about what ancestors do in different places? So these issues of, is there a way of systematically approaching these issues to give us a bit of a start in conceptualizing them across cultures?
Yeah.
Obviously accepting that wherever we're in a particular place, we still need to ask the people in the room what they think.
Well, you see, I think like Dev and Anthony, he's in the room, he's one of the real experts in this field. Let me react briefly, and then maybe Dev and Vikram, they want to take over. Is Andy Rasmussen here? He has written a paper on that. Andy, are you here? No, I don't see him. So you see, I think, again, this is a complex issue. I think the main issue is what are the carriers, the vehicles of culture. So in some countries, like you look at Burundi, Rwanda, they have a similar language, a similar cultural origin, and the idioms, they will be largely the same. When you look at some of the idioms that Andy Rasmussen described for Chad, you see some of these idioms, the Mechle Sap, the Liriach, the Mshkun, you see that come back in all the Islamic world. So you see that in the Middle East, you see that in Northern Africa. So then the carrier is not so much the local language, but then the carrier is more or less it's the Quran and the old Arab medicine. And that varies a lot around the world, but you always have to probe into the local culture to see what the idioms are and how to address them. This is a short answer to your question. Do we still have time? No, I think time's time is up. Okay.
I'm sure that Joop is going to be available in the next minutes to answer more questions, but we have to wrap up the session. Thanks very much for coming. And thanks, Joop, for your time.